before I would say you would scale something, I would say you need to start with empathy. I think empathy is usually the foundation to approaching any initiative for any business or industry that you're in. When you listen to what the users are saying and you're listening to what the business is saying, you have to see like, where do these things intersect? Where do they oppose one another? And where do you see overlap or you find some common ground? These are all very high level, like common sense things that you can use as a UX professional, or as a writer for any client.
This is Writers in Tech, a podcast where today's top content strategists, UX writers, and content designers share their well-kept industry secrets.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Writers in Tech, a podcast brought to you by the UX Writing Hub. The UX Writing Hub is a platform that helps people to get into the field of UX writing, but also help UX writers and content designers to excel at UX writing. We are a big, big, big community of many talented people, and we're here to help you with all of your challenges related to content, UX, and now also AI. And today we have a guest, a very special guest. Her name is Lina Ramon. Lina works as content design lead at BIM. The largest clients they have is the Audi North of North America, which is the project that she's currently working on, at least one of the projects she's working on. Lina, how are you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I just want to say, first of all, I followed your journey as like a valuable UX writing hub for many writers over the years. I even took one of your workshops really early on when you started it. So I'm really happy to see that this is going really strong now for you. And that there's so many people in our community now. So I'm really excited about that.
Thank you. Yes, we started early before many years.
Yeah.
Do you remember what workshop was it?
It was just like the UX writing basics, like the essentials to know. So it was like if you're transitioning between traditional copywriting or marketing writing and you're following the UX career path, then how to become a UX writer, so to speak. And it was really helpful. So thank you.
Thank you for the kind words. Amazing. So let's dive right in. Right now, our community changed. People are struggling with their struggles, for example, like managing their content design project or collaborating through content design projects or scaling their teams and that kind of thing. So I want you to share with me a time where you really nailed the project through collaboration. How do you keep things moving smoothly in such a fast-paced, agile setting?
Well, that is a great question because it is a difficult task. So where we work with Audi of North America, all of our projects are really fully collaborative. I mean, I know that sounds too good to be true. But what I mean by this is that first, we work very closely with our stakeholders. We determine their objectives and their key results, their OKRs. And then that happens before each quarter. And then each quarter has several, obviously, sprint cycles within that quarter. And then second, baked into our workflow or system, we have product and UX leads at the very top. They're positioned at a very crucial intake stage at the very beginning. So think of them as like a high-level UX discovery layer to some extent. So they help in specifically determining if the OKRs really fit within the objective and the scopes, or do they cross over into other objectives, or are they fully developed with the user in mind? I guess all of that is to say, we're really lucky with Audi of North America to have a very strong client relationship, and it's essentially pretty seamless in planning. And because of all this planning and agreement beforehand, everybody involved, the stakeholders and the teams alike, we're all moving in the same direction. So one thing that we know about Audi is that their core business values are really aligned with this idea of being driven by relentless optimism to build a better way. That's actually one of their core values. So our collaboration with them really aligns with that. We help ensure that all their digital products are not only just user-centric, but they fulfill the business initiatives. So That sounds like a lot of jargon, but it's really important to understand that the agreement on all the things at the beginning is key. Because from a UX perspective, it doesn't always mean that you agree on how it's going to be done. In other words, we don't ever abandon advocating for the user, even if the business objectives start to creep in. Here's a good example. I think of the book Articulating Design Decisions. It's a great book. I think the author is Tom Griever, I think is his name. But he said that empathy extends to your stakeholders. So we really try to remember that going into each of our cycles when we collaborate.
That's great. I will check this book. When you talked about OKRs, the first thing I thought about is the book Measure What Matters, but the book that I read to learn about OKRs in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's a good one. So the people that are not familiar with the concept of OKRs, or they're familiar with it, but they're having some hard times to define it. So can you give me an example without like giving away actual, you know, numbers or statistics, but like how an OKR might look like and how can you connect it to a content design task?
Oh, that's a really good question. So OKRs ladder up to the higher business objectives of obviously increasing traffic and flow and obviously increasing revenue and sales. But how we do that on a micro level is really interesting because in our UX, you know, department, we have designers that are just working on like the minutiae of like just working through a certain flow in the e-deposit cycle, for example, and just getting that just right so that it ladders back up to the main objective. I mean, these are all very incremental tasks that are packed into these sprints that ladder up to the larger OKR. So you can't really say like from a larger perspective, you'd be able to see it down the road in the future. But in the immediate sense, maybe that small little tweak that you're making from a UX standpoint or even content design, it's a small thing you're contributing to the bigger picture. So I hope that makes sense. But it is like without giving a concrete example, it's hard to say like, but specifically we're working on this CTA and this workflow within, like I said, e-deposit is something we're working on. So because we're eventually trying to get to a point where the people can buy the car online. But that's like the bigger objective, right? So anything that we do in the content design sense is like we're contributing to that bigger plan.
Okay, so an OKR might be like having more people buying online, the car online, and
right.
A bundle of content design tasks would fill these type of objectives. Like one task would be like write a CTA, one task would be like improve the user flow of the checkout, right? And then all of these together, tacking on top of each other, compounding after each design sprints, help you to get into this type of objective key results.
Exactly. It's like, again, everything's broken out into these smaller bite-sized kind of components or tasks. And then it all ladders up to that big picture of the goal. And hopefully by the end of every year, you look at the year and you say, we've done like, we did some pretty amazing things for Audi in the last few years. One of which was just their electric vehicle hub, just getting that up and running in a short amount of time. And also during the pandemic, when there was a lot of scarcity of vehicles, obviously because of supply and demand, we created something called Find Your Match for them, which was a tool used that if you cannot find your vehicle in the inventory exactly to your specifications, it'll find a match for you closely similar to the vehicle you're looking for. So it's like innovating solutions like that, especially given, again, during the pandemic, a lot of people had to rethink the way that they were doing business. And even it disrupted completely some of the maybe the main larger goals or objectives, OKRs that companies had. So, I mean, and Audi was no exception. Everybody had to make major adjustments. You know, car manufacturers all over the world had to make major adjustments. So
very cool. Sometimes you have this type of things that happens that just make you rethink your whole strategy. And the pandemic was creating a huge force towards digital transformations to companies that really needed it. So it was actually a good thing in that sense for many companies to have an incentive to digitize themselves. To like, who would believe that you'll buy a car online? But actually, that's probably is becoming the standard now.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's like it's becoming the norm, the standard, and now what customers expect because we can buy mostly anything online now. So why not vehicles? So
Do you think that in the future people would have to own car or like maybe subscribe to them like in a SaaS service?
That is such a great question. And there's a lot of chatter about subscription services and things of that nature, especially in the rideshare market and understanding what that looks like. So I wouldn't doubt that that's not going to be a model that you see down the road. Very soon, you'll see that probably subscription model. People may be able to just check out their vehicle and send rent, just like we rent a vehicle, right? So for your needs when you need to drive, and then when you don't need to drive, then you're not spending that money. It's a cost-effective way to have the convenience of a vehicle, but not the all of the maybe the headache of owning it. But a lot of people still advocate for ownership. There is a really strong sense of pride for people who own a vehicle of a certain stature, especially something like an Audi, you know, like right. People are really fanatical about the brand. They're really into it. So there's something about owning it that's also very dear to people.
I wonder if it's something that is maybe could be a generational thing, because I guess there's a lot of status around cars, like having a fancy car. And it's very like, I guess people that were growing up in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, it will be perceived different than maybe Gen Zs or maybe younger folks than that, that maybe care less about. Everybody cares about status and everybody are doing status signaling. But I wonder if maybe car status signaling is something that maybe people would be like, oh, okay, maybe I would just subscribe to how they, without owning it, and that would just work fine for me.
Yeah, but you also see on the flip side, you also see a lot of brand loyalty that's driven by like almost like a culture or counterculture. I mean, look at all the people who buy Teslas. That's like a movement. There's a whole movement behind that. And people are really like fanatical about their Tesla and owning the Tesla and kind of what Tesla represents, for better or for worse. But all of that said, I think that there's room in that world for both, right? There's room in the world for people who want the convenience and are not necessarily attached to any brands. They just want the convenience of having it and they're looking for a more cost-effective solution versus people who are really still focused on the status and what that brings for them, what it means for them. And I think all of that's a really great point to bring around to user experience, because that is essentially what you're striving to do, is find out what is most important to that particular person, customer, user, and tailor that experience for them. So there will be situations where in the future, I'm sure car manufacturers will offer the both, when, you know, so that you have the option, so that they're not excluding any users or potential customers down the road. So
right. And subscription or not, there's still the status game here, because once subscribe to Tesla while the other subscribe to Audi and the other one subscribe to Kia, and those would be like the fact that you chose to do that type of subscription is also like based on, I guess, class or something like that.
Yeah. And then that opens up a whole world of how that service model looks like for tiered structure and what is all included in those packages for tiered packages to buy, etc. So yeah, I mean, that's a whole universe of user experience yet to be starting to be broached, and I'm sure that we'll see a lot of it in the future.
Where do you see the field of UX writing and content design heading in that sense? So there are so many challenges around the road, and this is only one of them, like automotive, right? So that's like only a very narrow specific challenge, but now with the Apple Vision Pro, which is like a new universe for people, new old universe for people, and with AI stepping out the AI game, everything is kind of reshuffled right now. And all of the challenges are also kind of shuffling their way. Just like 25 years ago, we had new challenges after like people start building websites, for example. And once mobile was introduced in 2007, so also building apps, that's another challenge. So every kind of revolution brings their own challenges. So where do you see that our industry is heading when it comes to communicating digital experiences in all of these like changing landscapes?
Well, I think that's a great question, because you've mentioned AI, and of course that's on everybody's mind right now. It's literally on the, you know, tongue of everybody talking about AI. How is AI going to affect? But I think fundamentally and crucially at its core, our job as UX writers is to always to help, because content is extremely important and so is context. So UX writers help ensure that every experience as we know, is seamless, that it's useful, that it's reliable, and as often, depending on the circumstances, that it's enjoyable, right? So UX writing is obviously going to continue to evolve with the technology. We're going to have to adapt to new interfaces, to new user behaviors. There's going to be a lot of emphasis, and there is now, on inclusivity, more conversational tone, more personalized interactions, but not too personalized where it borders into kind of creepy. But we're trying to enhance user engagement, and we're seeing that all the time. So you mentioned AI, and I think with the advent of that, I think our mantle to carry as UX writers will be to check AI at the door, meaning like we're going to have to pivot. We're still going to be writing and creating good content and within context, but it's to be editors. We're going to be looking for those use cases, and we're going to be looking at hallucinations. And it's a big responsibility ultimately, because as you well know, words, text, language are still how we place the context of things. We still need an intuitive and an ethical filter, right? For whatever it is you're producing, alt text, closed captioning, user flows, documentation, video scripts. At Config last year, I don't know if you were able to attend virtually, but the CEO of Figma said that AI is going to bring you a good first draft, and then humans are going to be able to turn those into world-class products. So with AI too, I think one other thing I just thought of is how we're going to be able to overcome articulation barriers, right? So that writers, UX writers, the job of us will be that we have to create more laser-focused, factual, and ethical prompts that go into UI. That's going to be an asset that all UX writers are going to have, is just being able to write really airtight, strong prompts so that we're protecting and we're not leaving the user behind.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it happens. I mean, it's so crazy because every day there's something new in AI that you read about, and it just blows your mind how quickly this is evolving and changing. And so we're going to have to just move as closely and quickly. And we also, again, like I said, very thoughtfully as writers, we have to stay true to what our mission is. And our mission is the person who's receiving the information and being empathetic to that person and not getting lost in all of the bells and whistles and all of the things that AI can help us with. But it's also to be mindful that we have to be the keepers. We have to watch what it's doing. We can't just let it go run amok.
I couldn't agree more. You know, it's mind-blowing, the amount of information. It's like, I don't think it's humanly possible to digest all of the information that there is right now about AI and AI tools and what it can do, because there's so much you can do with it. And what I found is that it doesn't matter really, because we have design principles. And if we're sticking to those design principles, and you said it right, focusing on the end user and what they need. So it doesn't matter, because I've been in this industry for a while now. I don't know if I'm a veteran, but I've been here for a while. And in 2017, 2018, everybody were talking about blockchain.
Yeah.
And 3 years before that, everybody were talking about mobile.
Yeah.
It's like, of course, that mobile responsive was like, now it's a standard and, you know, that's what we do. And also, like, people were talking about blockchain, which is not a standard yet. And many people also talked about VR for many years. And as designers, the idea was always to see, okay, that's what we have today. That's what AI can do today. That's what VR can do today, which is the Apple Vision Pro or the Meta Quest, whatever it's named. And this is the type of technology people we have, developers. And based on that, how could we provide the best possible experience for the end user, regardless to trends?
Exactly. I think that that's a great word for it, because we're going to see a lot of products come out like very quickly, but it's being able to shake all of that out and figure out which ones are actually going to be the most useful. I almost compare it to when social media was rolled out right? So the idea of like certain platforms just kind of died away. And why was that? Because of user experience. So I think that's a great analogy. You're going to see multiple types of platforms of AI, multiple types of GPTs, but time is going to tell which one of these actually stand for the user in the most ethical way, but also in the most useful way to people who are ultimately using the digital products versus people out there just trying to see how far they can take the technology.
And it's really easy, by the way, just like in blockchain, where every company just added the term blockchain
right
to their names. There's also a famous story about this beverage company that just changed their name to like beverage name, blockchain, just to get more traction. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so now everybody wants to have that AI juice. So they just plug in OpenAI and give you this like blah, blah, blah of generated content wherever they can. And it's really easy to notice when the experience is just annoying and terrible because
the
fact that you can generate content or generate anything, it doesn't mean that you actually need to do it. And to be honest, the AI stuff that you see actually in the back end of products, actually, that's what brings the best possible experience. When you record a video and you see that automatically it's generate you the translation, that's a good experience. That's a fantastic experience. So that's the type of experience we should aim for. The aha moments where people see this and they say, oh, that's amazing. I can't believe the technology just made it for me. And 2 years from now, it's probably going to be the standard for everyone.
Right. And I think to your point about the back end and seeing that kind of miraculous ability, like a translation, which is very valuable, right? But even then, you're still going to need a UX writer or some sort of an editor to ensure that the context remains intact in that translation. 100%. Because again, because of languages and different nuances of language and culture, things can mean very different things and you don't want to obviously offend or miss the mark. So there's still a need, there's going to be a need for humans to be involved in that process.
Yeah, you know, like two episodes ago, we've interviewed Michal from Localization Station. She's like this
localization expert. I listened to that. Yeah, I listened to that. That was a wonderful podcast.
Thanks. And she was blowing me away with the ideas about localization and how far are we from understanding even the challenges of localizing your products to different markets. Mm-hmm. So obviously you must have people in charge in place on editing, doing prompt design, doing prompt editing, because the prompts also run in the backend. That's what I found, that you need to learn how to ask the machine to do what you want it to do. Otherwise, you're going to get, as you said, hallucinations or bias type of outcome, which is terrible. I just listened to this podcast with this founder. He is creating this tool for doctors, and it helps him to do this, just the first soap, the first sorting for doctors. And they wrote some kind of a prompt that showed to the doctor the word three times, I'll kill you, I'll kill you, I'll kill you.
Wow.
You don't want that. You don't want that.
No, that's something that's a big mistake. And again, with the translator, the localization expert that you interviewed a while ago talked about the importance of linguists being assigned and people understanding true context of things. Because to your point, again, you can feed whatever you want into it in the front end. But if you're not asking it a very thoughtful, well-designed, well-crafted prompt, then you're going to get probably something that's not usable or could be potentially dangerous or, you know, offensive, or it's a machine. You know, at the end of the day, we still have to remember it's a machine and it's scraping whatever and aggregating whatever is out there to create the answer for you. It doesn't care about ethics. It's not sentient. So it's not sentient, sorry. So it's not thinking in that way. That's why the human aspect of this is so important.
And by the way, you know, like what another cool story I have from 2 days ago? Have you heard about the Air Canada story? What happens with them 2 days ago?
Yes, the chatbot gave the person the false information, but now he's suing Air Canada, right? For this? Apparently they gave him his money back.
Exactly. So basically what's happening is that the chatbot made a mistake. This guy was like he had to cancel his flight due to like a funeral or something like that, something that was like extremely urgent. And the chatbot said something like that about getting the money back. And mm-hmm. when he talked with them like 90 days after, they told him, hey, to be honest, the chatbot was saying false information. And if you'll go into our policy, that's actually the policy that we have. But here is $200 and you can get them. And he decided to go to law court with them. And actually, just 2 days ago, he won the lawsuit.
Yeah.
And that's, I think it's called in English, prejudice.
Yeah. So in this case, interestingly, and now I remember reading about this. So yeah, he won this lawsuit. It was because they didn't check the lead. This is extremely important too. This gets to what is important from the legal standpoint. This is about policy and, you know, terms and conditions. And there's somebody in the department at Air Canada that is a human being that is drawing these terms and conditions up, and they're looking at it through and filtering it through a legal department. And the chatbot wasn't filtered that way. So see what happened. Something fell through the cracks and the company was forced to then have to comply with what the chatbot said because it wasn't filtered through any checks or balances through the legal department. So that's also something that I've been reading more and more about online in terms of AI and some of the checkpoints that we need to be like really aware of. Especially again, from a writer standpoint, a UX writer standpoint, is that I know personally our client, Audi of North America, their legal department is very airtight. It's very stringent. And it's good that way because that's what that's for. It's to ensure that the consumer isn't put in a bad position, but also so that the company isn't in a bad position. But it seems that wasn't the case at Air Canada. So they're probably going to really now be looking at how do we filter our chatbots properly and prompt correctly through a legal filter so that we can ensure that that doesn't happen again. Because otherwise their chatbot's going to be giving away free trips to everybody, which would be great, but,
it's great, right?
but not good for them, you know, not good for them. So
definitely. That's such an interesting, like, challenges that we have right now that we didn't have before. And I find it as a really good opportunity for many people.
Yeah, that's a great story, though. I do remember seeing that the other day.
Yeah, I just read it. So I want to talk with you a little bit about, so you said you worked mostly with the Audi North America client, but you work with different industries as well. I want to ask you about scaling your content and content strategy through different industries. Like, how do you make this shift? And what type of pattern do you think you have that you could actually duplicate and use in the different industries, if that makes sense?
Oh, yeah, no, that makes sense. Well, this sounds a little obvious, but I think before I would say you would scale something, I would say you need to start with empathy. I think empathy is usually the foundation to approaching any initiative for any business or industry that you're in. When you listen to what the users are saying and you're listening to what the business is saying, you have to see like, where do these things intersect? Where do they oppose one another? And where do you see overlap or you find some common ground? These are all very high level, like common sense things that you can use as a UX professional, or as a writer for any client. I like to think of this like that everybody involved is a character in a book or a movie, right? So you have the protagonist, the person who wants to do the thing, the user. And then you have the antagonist. And sorry, sometimes that's the business. Sometimes the business is the protagonist. And then you have UX. So you have several factors. You've got the supporting cast of characters that surround a challenge, what the user is wanting to do, but their pain points. And characters can include the place or the setting or the environment and the barriers, because that's where accessibility comes in. So strategy only really applies like when you fully understand your full cast of characters, their motivations, the place and era of time that you're working in. And context, again, we were talking about context earlier. Context is really key. When you have empathy and you have research and data on your side and context, then all the strategy follows. So, and as you know, like strategy can be long-term, it can be short-term, but a lot of things that we put forth as strategy really relies on us seeing each other's perspective. It's less about like, I want to make this happen. I want to make XYZ happen, and more about What does the user need to hear? What do they need to see? Why do they need to see it? When do they need to see it? How do they need to receive this information? A little while ago, I wrote a LinkedIn post about the Buddhist view of compassion, right? And UX practice and how those two things intersect. And compassion really kind of cools off all the sense of like, imagine urgency, this fiery, like, oh my goodness, we have to get this thing done right now, right? So empathy is a part of this, compassion. It's like a metaphor to describe it as like UX is like a cool drink of water in the desert. After the user has been going through maybe like a lot of like dark patterns, the hot sands of the dark patterns, and they're not getting what they need, or they're going up all these hills, these sand dunes, right? But it's all unhelpful content just to get to where they need to be. So I think in all industries, we're making a, like real good progress in UX. And we're constantly showing cases now more and more that templates don't work. Empty content that doesn't mean anything to the user and design really doesn't cut it anymore with real people, because real people are the people who are using the products. And in some ways, again, we're talking about AI earlier. With AI on the rise, we keep talking about the user this, the user that. So it even seems a little outdated to be calling it user experience. We need to maybe return to human experience, the human HX instead of UX. So, but to answer your question, I think all of this is for applicable to any business or industry. But the foundation is empathy and compassion, understanding where people are, meeting them where they are.
I think that my takeaway from your answer, my main takeaway from your answer, is the fact that before anything else, we are storytellers. If we will tell the story of our users as antagonist and the protagonist and mm-hmm. and empathize with them, basically it will help us to walk in their shoes. And I loved also your metaphor or analogy about UX being the cool drink in the desert and giving people like a positive experience after they've been witnessing so much terrible experiences. And I wonder how I could apply it better to my job. Like, how can I be a better storyteller for my users so I could write better? Eventually, at the end of the iceberg, it's me writing user interface.
Yeah.
And the story is just the iceberg itself. And the tip of the iceberg is just the UI, but there is so much below it. So I wonder how I could incorporate it in order to become a better UX writer.
I think it's continuing to listen to the data and the feedback that you're getting from people, because obviously that's key, because the more of that you continue to incorporate into your findings of understanding, not just like the actual quantitative data, but the qualitative, what people are saying, the feedback you're receiving, how you're incorporating that back into the flow. Because as you know, it's a constantly iterative process. Nothing is ever done. So you're always going to be writing more, understanding more, incorporating more into that, so that it's, you're never going to get this perfect state, but you'll always have something to strive for. And I think that's really like the core of UX, you know, the fundamentals of UX is that it's never going to be finished. There's always better experiences to strive for. And again, with AI, bringing that up again, but that's going to be one of the major challenges we face, is using it for good, but not you overusing it or relying on it too much. So that, again, we're still trying to have keep the user in our sights, in the forefront.
I wonder how we should name this episode.
The human experience.
the human experience.
Right. Or something along those lines. But I don't know. It's a good question. I think a lot of this conversation around the AI and how we will be using it in the future is definitely on people's minds. And I think everybody's trying to get a hot take on like, what, how are you using it and what are you doing with it? So there's a lot of that kind of experimental chatter going on right now. And I'm always fascinated to read more and more about actual, you know, use cases where somebody, again, like the article that you brought up, or anything, examples of where maybe AI is failing, examples of where AI is helping, I'm very fascinated personally between you and I about prompt engineering and what that's going to mean and how serious people are going to take that. I know as writers, you can't stress enough that writing something to the specifications exactly what you want, there's still going to be room for trial and error there in terms of what you put in and what it's going to generate for you. So there's still going to be multiple tries. Even if you write the most beautiful prompt and it's the most exact, ethical, it hits every single checkpoint, there's still going to be room to enhance. So I've been playing a lot around with ChatGPT. I've been playing with Midjourney, you know, just out of curiosity. I know, I don't remember what was Google just released their text to video the other day. Mm-hmm. Do you know what it's called? And OpenAI released theirs as well. Sonos?
Stoa is by OpenAI. Mm-hmm. Google's just rebranded Bard as Gemini, I believe, but I don't remember the text to video.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So as I said, it doesn't like, it's such a crazy challenge to digest all of this. And like in 1 week from now, it's not going to be even relevant anymore because something newer is going to pop.
They'll find something like extremely wrong with it and they'll have to recalibrate it but you know, the text to video stuff, I don't know if you saw some of the previews. It's pretty frighteningly, like it's good, but it also makes you think of how could somebody use this in the wrong way? You know,
it's scary.
100%. But it's like good, scary. It's like part of you is like, okay, this could be used for so many good things.
And then part of me is like, Hollywood is dead.
Yeah. Think about actors no more. Don't need actors anymore. Don't need writers anymore. But also deepfakes and politics and the geopolitical repercussions of using this is, I mean, who knows? I mean, we've already seen some of that. And it's quite scary what it can do. So we'll see.
And also talking about prompt engineering, it's like, you know, you could have the exact same prompt in two different LLMs, like one ChatGPT, one Claude, or like another LLM, Llama by Facebook. And you'll get obviously completely different results because it's like a completely different database.
Yeah, it's aggregating from different sources. Yeah.
And also using the exact same prompt in different time. Like one day I will do that and like 2 months after I will prompt the exact same prompt. It will give me, I guess, it will give me different outcomes. So we can't really tame the beast, I feel like. It's like it just do whatever we want to do. It doesn't really ask us like or wait for us to design our prompt in a better way.
Yeah, I think that's why I think it's smart that a lot of people are jumping on this very early from an ethical standpoint. I saw that as soon as the release of the text to video, a bunch of companies banded together to meet on understanding what the ethical repercussions of that will be. So, I mean, all of what you're saying is true, but I do think that humans still play a huge part in this and that they know now, like before it becomes out of control, they know. We know what we can do with it, but should we do it? And when should people step in and be, like I said earlier, the checkpoint of, wait a minute, we need somebody to read this. We need somebody to look at this. We need somebody, even like a video script or something. I mean, it could be something as simple as that, but you need people to make that distinction. Because like you said, it's aggregating from a different source. The two GPTs were aggregating from different sources, and they were getting different outcomes. But every day the news cycle is changing. So it's like just more information is being churned through. What's even fascinating to me is the idea of, and I'm not articulating this well, but there's the idea of the fact that GPTs are basically almost like eating up the information. And when it starts to kind of eat, we're going to get to a point where it comes full circle and it starts eating itself because it's got some, let's just call it like junk information that it's taking in. And then it keeps feeding itself on the same junk information. And pretty soon it's just kind of like this revolving cycle of bad information over and over again, because it's just taking what is out there and putting it in the same. If there's all kinds of, if AI is spitting back out that, it's also ingesting it, right? So it's ingesting its own bad information or data, right? So eventually it's going to get to a point where like it's like it implodes. So I'll send you this article. It's really fascinating. AI is going to eat itself. That was the main idea, was AI will eventually eat itself.
Maybe that should be the name of the episode.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to be the harbinger, the person that's predicting that, because there's obviously some social scientists and people studying who are doing this, who are actual researchers that have much better idea than I do about it. But
thank you so much for being here with me today. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated this talk. I really am happy that you're continuing a great, strong community of UX writers. So keep it up. I'll be watching.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for joining us for another episode of Writers in Tech, a podcast brought to you by the UX Writing Hub. My name is Yuval Keshtecher. I am the founder of the UX Writing Hub, and I've created this place for you to learn everything about UX writing, content design, UX content, and now also how it collides with AI as well, which has kind of become the theme of the last few episodes, like AI and content design, which is quite cool. I like it. I do a lot of research about AI all the time because I also think it's taking us to an interesting path to the future. So thank you for joining us. If you're interested to get into the field of UX writing, check one of our free courses. We have the free AI for UX course and the free Taste of UX Writing course. One is for people that want to get into UX writing, and the other one is for people that want to learn more about AI and UX. And that's it. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.